"Follow me," Teodoro said. He carried a lantern and a flashlight. A machete was slung over his back. We headed out of town for the short walk towards the ruins. The night was dark. The further we walked from town, the louder the night became. Nightbirds fluttered among the trees. An insect drone throbbed from the floor of the jungle and resonated throughout the night air, adding to the eeriness. Teodoro led me to a well-disguised pathway. We stooped and crawled inside the jungle-blanketed passageway, and once inside, the path opened. Teodoro paused, lit the kerosene lantern, and handed me the flashlight. The path was narrow. The sound of water came up from the river in a low murmur. I remembered that Stevens and Catherwood forded a river following the path their guide opened with a machete, but I was distracted when something brushed my cheek and my thoughts of the adventurous duo vanished. Suddenly, off to the left, I spied two glowing red eyes. Teodoro whispered, "Balam," and I understood it was a jaguar. As we drew closer, it bounded into the forest. He said visual contact of a jaguar was rare and a good sign. In the darkness, I saw a faint light ahead. As we approached, it appeared as a glowing purplish light. At first, I thought someone was in front of us, but when the light divided into several smaller orbs, I realized it was not another lantern. "Son las luces de los ancestros," Teodoro whispered as he surveyed the area. He said the lights were the old ones, the ancestors. I thought about the unexplained lights that appeared at ceremonies at home. The elders said they were spirits of the ancestors. Once Teodoro was sure that we were alone, he guided me up the steps of a temple to the center of the plaza. There, in the pitch-black darkness, he doused his lantern and leaned back to relax. "Ahora debemos esperar," he told me quietly. "Now we must wait." I leaned back and looked toward the heavens. Overhead, the three-quarter moon traveled across the sky. The intolerable white heat of the day turned into a cool, dark-black mystery set with millions of tiny stars. Under these flashing jewels, the night critters came. Bats dipped and swirled overhead, while below, various unknown creatures scurried among the ancient buildings. Neither of us spoke for the next 3 hours. When I felt myself dozing off, it happened. "They are here," Teodoro whispered. Then I saw them, small balls of light flickering around the ancient plaza and playfully danced back and forth. As I sat there, transfixed by the scene unfolding in front of me, one light broke off from its gliding antics and moved in front of me. The other lights floated into formation behind it. They hovered there and then disappeared into the night air. "Ustedes es uno de nosotros," Teodoro said. "You are one of us." Ghosties, my ghoulies, my moth people, welcome to Noctivagant, the show about the strange, paranormal, otherworldly, and the people who write books about it. My name is Nick, and I am joined by the blue-skinned giants, Jay and Rory Wicks.
Blue? I'm white.
You're also very small.
I just want to be tall.
On this show, we are going to discuss, dissect, and review the best and worst in the world of paranormal conspiracy literature. So settle in, buckle up, and prepare for a walk on the midnight roads of Noctivagant.
I hope you enjoyed that message from our sponsor, the Illuminati.
What? We're sponsored?
When did they start sponsoring us?
We made it?
Shh. They're paying me in organs.
Wait. Okay. At the risk of immediately spinning us off topic, what are you doing with said organs?
That's classified and complicated, and also, I don't entirely know. At night, I go outside with the organ bag, and then I go away for a while. And when I come back, there's no organs. There's loose jewels. And I'm excited for a while, like, yay, gemstones, I'm rich. And then I go away for a while again in a slightly different way. And when I wake up, I'm back in my bed. My alarm's going off, and I have to go to work.
Are you physically tired when you wake up? Do you have mud on your shoes?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, okay. So this is what we call a divergent personality, and we need to get you to the home.
I think it's fine.
Oh, divergent personality, and I thought alien abduction.
I feel like that's the more likely one. Either that or I'm possessed.
You know,
all viable options.
Why don't we just call it all three and throw you in a hole?
Yay!
So, welcome back, guys. We are here today not to talk about Jay's nighttime antics, though that would be a fun episode to its own. We are here to talk about the book Sky People, Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica by Artie Sixkiller Clark.
A.K.A. her night antics.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
So this is a very, very interesting little book. This is one of kind of several in a similar vein that Clark has written, in which she, in this book, goes on an adventure across South and Central America to talk to the indigenous Maya people about their experiences with UFOs. So what did we think, guys, just kind of off the cuff?
This book fascinated me. I really, really enjoyed this one. Like, honestly, the chapter about her encounter with Rodrigo, I barely remember most of what he said about the actual sky people. I just found that chapter on its own so compelling and weirdly emotional. I loved this entire book.
Which one was he again?
He was the hotel owner that kept telling her, like, oh, I'm the gardener. Like, that's
right.
That 94-year-old man that looked 55 and just casually talked about, like, oh, yeah, the wise men are with the sky people now. That's not important. What's important is how ravishing you look tonight.
Yeah, no, I like that. The undercover boss. I am a simple groundskeeper. He was straight up an anime villain. You realize that? Like, that's a straight up anime trope. Oh, the simple butler or the gardener, but he is truly the demon lord.
It's literally one of the first major plot points in One Piece.
Yeah. Yeah, I told you. It's a fucking trope. Yeah. No, Rodrigo was great, though.
Yeah.
Rory, what did you think?
Overall, I thought the book was very interesting, like a lot of books in this realm that we read. I think the thing that I found the most interesting was like a deep dive into like the Maya culture, Mayan culture, mm-hmm. and stuff like that, just because it's one of the, you know, one of the earlier cultures, and we can see where a lot of parallels are drawn from in later years when we're looking at the like these kind of topics, and I find that endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I think one thing this is something that I knew, but I mean, I had never really read too much of the Maya perspective. What fascinates me about the Maya is this is a case where we have a culture that most people just like on the street would deem an ancient culture, like in the same breath as like the ancient Greeks, the ancient Egyptians, things like that. And yet we have surviving members of that civilization that have kept those traditions largely intact. And that's pretty unique as far as I'm aware of.
Yeah. They mentioned in the Mexico section of the book, like the Lacandons. Is that who I'm thinking of? The Lacandons, who lived so deep in the jungle that they still have their pre-conquest traditions largely intact because the conquistadors just straight up didn't get to them.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, okay, so you... one of the only other cultures that I can think of that has that long of just an uninterrupted line are some of the Australian Aboriginal tribes.
That's right.
Way out in the outback, where like the Australian government was much less able to enforce their bullshit colonial policies on them. And it's just like, nah, we remember back about 75,000 years. It's like, how do you even do that?
I'm sorry. It's just, so basically that's the secret. If you want to preserve your local culture, you just have to position it in such a location that's so difficult to get to, Europeans just can't be fucked to do it.
Yeah.
That's how you do it. That's the secret. We've figured it out. I really enjoyed it. I will say this, it was a little difficult to summarize just because the stories are all over the place.
Yes.
I mean, obviously. So yeah, throughout this book, she journeys through various countries, which is how the book is structured. Whereas, like, here is all the stories that she found in Belize, and then Honduras, and then Mexico.
Kind of like Meet Me in Atlantis.
Kind of, yeah. And for that reason, I didn't do what I normally do, where I tried to kind of just break the book apart into central themes and then group them like that. I tried to keep it mostly linear in following the trip that she took.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, we jump around a little bit, but I think I tried to find a couple good through lines that's, I think, kind of get at what were some of the larger themes that emerged throughout all these stories.
Yeah.
But that said, there's a lot in here that we are not going to get a chance to get to, which saddened me, because there's some stories which they simply are iconoclasts even within this book. Like, for example, the UFO that abducted an alligator.
Yeah.
I loved that story. I don't know why I love that story, considering they dropped off a dead alligator and then picked up a new one. I don't like them killing alligators. But at the same time, can you imagine, like, you're a farmer out working your day, and then a UFO zips over and just drops an 8-foot dead alligator on you?
I'd probably scream, but, you know.
We all know about my constant joke of every UFO crash ever is because a bunch of teenage aliens took mom's car and fucked up. I'm just picturing just a bunch of undergrad xenobiology students just approaching a random human in Guatemala sobbing as they have this dead alligator. And they're like, we were just supposed to tag it. We don't know what we did.
What were you feeding it? Corn. Isn't that what everything on this planet eats is corn?
You're thinking of Americans.
Oh.
Okay. All right. No.
I'm sorry. Just the on visual alone, you can't blame them. You know, the deep scales, the crotchetiness, the teeth.
I'm just picturing this exhausted Guatemalan farmer who probably has 5 children just being like, stop. Cry. Okay, calm down. We're going to get you another alligator. I'm going to make sure you do your project right this time. It's going to be fine. No one's going back on academic probation. It's going to be okay.
I don't know why that story tickled me so much. But yeah, that and many other great stories we're not going to have a chance to get to. So this is another book. Once again, I would recommend, if people are interested, go out and read it. If nothing else, it's really interesting to get a really clear look at how the UFO phenomenon is viewed by a culture that isn't in North America or Europe, considering we have a very, I guess, Western-centric viewpoint of the UFO phenomenon, at least in terms of the general literature and the dialogue that's available to us here in America.
Yeah. Like, That's kind of inevitable, especially with, like, as it gets repeated in this book a lot. That was another thing I found so fascinating about this book is, among our culture, UFO shit is, you know, obviously treated as a joke, or you're allowed to just assume it's not real, and it's associated with you know, essentially delusional thinking.
In some parts, yeah.
In like mainstream our culture.
Yeah.
And in this, in most of these cultures, Artie was tripping over story after story. Like, the driver she had in fucking Guatemala, who every single day he was like, yo, I just called 5 of my cousins, and each of them have 3 stories that they want to tell you, and each of them knows 5 other people that's like, yeah, aliens have been coming into my shop for years, they don't pay.
Well, and I think that the one thing that was very interesting there, which we'll get into in the summary a bit, is the fact that the reason that she had such wild success was because they kind of saw her less as a colonizer and more as a corollary. Because she is a native North American. She's from the Choctaw and Cherokee tribes.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to me how many doors that opened.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I mean, of course it would, when you really, you know, think about it, especially considering the ancient Maya people probably did have at least some knowledge or passing relations with the people in the to the north.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just, you know, it's not a kind of an aspect of history you think about, especially how history is taught in our schools in the modern day. At least I remember, like, thinking specifically K-12 education, kindergarten through end of high school. very much history began when colonization began.
Yeah.
You don't think about how those ancient peoples might have interacted, the relationships they'd have formed with each other, because of course they did. You know, that's their neighbors. And now that was interesting to me. It was a good reminder, you know, to always kind of keep that, keep that in mind, that that is the reality of it, that things were happening at the entire, you know, entire sagas and epics happened long, long before we ever thought to go there.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I didn't even think about that really when thinking about this.
Yeah, but, you see that?
Yeah.
It's because you're a colonizer.
I mean, I am I am a white American.
Yeah. All right, are we ready to get into it?
Yes.
Okay. Part one, Purple Deserts and Giant Perverts. We know the UFO story. It's a tale of secret government labs, invasive experimentation, and black-eyed demon children from beyond the stars. It is a horror story, one that has been thoroughly baked into the American psyche by tinfoil saucers on television, movies, and podcasts. And judging by American media alone, one may be tempted to think that all aliens are, at best, malevolent molesters, or at worst, demonic soul eaters arisen from the darkest pits of human suffering. But the USA isn't the world, and our very specific pop cultural interpretation of the UFO phenomenon, while now widespread, is likely as myopic as it seems. To get a better image of what UFOs are or might represent, we need to venture outwards, to go to foreign places, to meet the people there, and to try to see the phenomenon through their eyes. This must be done without judgment, without pretense, and, if the experience of today's author is any indication, with a truckload of Coca-Cola. R.D. Sixkiller Clark, a native North American and professor at Montana State University, set out to follow in the footsteps of legendary explorers and documentarians of the Mayan culture, John Lloyd Stevens and Frederick Catherwood, whose tales of exploring South American ruins had so inspired her as a child. Traveling over 20,000 miles spread across 14 trips throughout Central and South America, she followed in their footsteps, touring the many ancient Maya sites they are credited with discovering in the halls of Western academia. Though, of course, the locals may take issue with this claim due to the fact that Stevens and Catherwoods could only discover these ruins with the aid of locals who already knew they were there. But not content to merely play tourist, Clark came with an additional objective in mind: to connect with the local Maya people, to learn firsthand of their culture and customs, and to probe into the mystery of UFOs when viewed through the Maya cultural lens. As Clark well knows from her own upbringing in the Cherokee and Choctaw tribes, many Native American cultures have their own stories of visitors from the stars. They are called sky gods, or sky people. They often come down on beams of light, perform miracle healings, and speak of the deep spiritual and genetic connections they share with the native populations. Stories which, of course, have been systematically ignored in the modern day. Quote, "The Enlightenment's insistence on an objective, sterile, and amoral investigation marshaled in a new era that valued supposed rationality. The authority of truth once given to traditional wisdom was relegated to myth and legend. The mystical and spiritual experiences of humanity were regarded as non-trustworthy and interpreted as tall tales because they could not be proven. Even stories that appeared almost universally in tribal cultures around the world were not recognized as legitimate by modern scholars." She received these stories without judgment or any efforts to establish their veracity. Rather than investigate the objective truth of UFOs, she sought to find the subjective truth of the Maya people. She only hired local guides, translators, and honored the customs of gift-giving with each stop she made. This, coupled with her indigenous heritage, which was a bit of a novelty to the Maya people, opened doors that had remained stubbornly sealed to the few white researchers who'd ever tried trotting on the ground she now walked on. And while their stories were varied and often deferred depending on which tribe or the area the storyteller came from, she soon began to note several odd through lines which seemed to hint at some deeper truth about the phenomenon, the Maya people, and the future of life on Earth. Her journey began in Belize in December of 2003. Far from the shanty town of ramshackle dwellings Catherwood and Stevens came upon in 1839, Clark found Belize City to be a bustling and historic town, possessing of a vibrant cultural heritage. It is also there that she met the first of what will become a revolving door of friendly guides, who were her principal agents and assistants during her adventures, this one being Buddy, a Red Carib Indian. Much like the guides who came after him, Buddy quickly proved to be an invaluable resource in coaxing UFO stories out of the locals. In fact, during Clark's very first night in Belize, he delivered by bringing her along to crash his cousin's wedding. While there, she was introduced to a young woman named Serena, who told her about the backwards walking people her grandfather had seen close to a century prior. He described them as tall and skinny, with massive legs that had a sort of hypermobile knee joint, allowing the entity to walk forward and backwards with ease. Serena herself had seen them at a distance on a number of occasions. They came in cigar-shaped craft, and according to her grandfather, had skin like that of a snake. However, one must be careful not to approach these visitors. According to Serena and several other witnesses present at the wedding, these backward-walking tobacconauts are also dangerous rapists, and like the giants of old, are known to abduct women to force them to bear their children. Later on, during her time in Belize, Clark would again encounter stories of these giant spacemen. Near the city of San Ignacio lay a large natural cave system that extended miles underground. It was known that the Maya used this system for some unknown purpose due to the presence of human remains and pottery shards dating from 200 CE. Though, according to a local Maya man and fruit stand proprietor, the Maya weren't the only ones to use this system. Growing up, he heard many tales of blue-skinned space giants living within. According to him, the giants were a topic of deep anxiety among the locals due to their propensity for violent perversion. Once, as a boy, the fruit stand vendor and his friends tried to explore those caves, hoping to find Maya artifacts. To their shock, rather than pottery shards, they found a massive skull with eye sockets on the sides and the front, so large that it took two of them to carry it out. The skull sat atop a disturbed square of earth. As he explained, quote, "The space giants had a strange method of burial. They buried their dead in a square grave with the bodies sitting upright."
It's much more comfortable.
good for the posture.
Yeah. Yeah.
They returned to the village with their find, but did not receive the hero's reception that they'd been hoping for. Rather, the witness's grandfather was outraged. He feared reprisals should the giants return to find the grave disturbed. So they returned, intent to leave the skull where they'd found it, but they were unable to locate the grave again. So they buried it out in the jungle until a few years later, when they again exhumed it with intent to show it to a well-known wise man near the Guatemalan border. However, when they arrived and unveiled the skull, one of the locals went ballistic. He drew his machete and smashed the skull to pieces. As they would learn later, the man's daughter had gone missing 50 years prior, an apparent victim of the giants. Six of his 11 sons then died trying to rescue their sister, either from being hurled off cliffs or gruesomely nailed to trees.
Which is just so fucked.
Yeah, no, that story's fucked up.
Just so fucked.
Though we may be heartened to learn that, while there may be evil, lascivious space giants lurking about, they are far from the standard when it came to the stories Clark collected. In fact, the indigenous Maya frequently inform Clark that while such predatory visitors do exist, they are but one of many types of sky people. In a small Belizean village, she was introduced to an elder named Raul Manuel, who claimed to have frequently and willingly gone with another type of sky people to aid them on their various projects. In his travels, he reports being taken to a massive city in the sky, an invisible community where a friendly extraterrestrial race worked to save their imperiled homeworld. And while it'd be easy to chalk these stories up to fantasy or a simple prank, the fact was that Manuel did have a bad habit of vanishing for weeks at a time, and had for his entire life. His first journey occurred when he was 9 years old, and his memories of it are therefore a little fragmented. He remembered being taken into the sky by a bright light, and then a cold, sterile room made of dull metal. Then he was led to a chamber that seemed to contain a miniature forest, filled with plants and flowers, where he was made to work as a gardener until he was returned just in time for his birthday party. At first, he believed this experience was a dream, till it happened again, and again. Over time, his role grew from unexpected landscaper to that of a professor. They took him so he could teach them about the plants of his area and the powerful medicines therein. Often, he would accompany ground teams to collect samples of these plants, usually in the company of two other boys who appear to have been taken from somewhere else in the world. One was Asian and the other black. While none of these boys shared a language, they found they could implicitly understand each other whilst on a mission for the Sky People. When he was older, they took him to their planet for the first but not last time. He described it as a purple-gray desert world, populated only by dust, rocks, and wind. They lived in massive chambers underground, near deep reservoirs of water, and had, since some unnamed catastrophe, decimated their world and forced them underground. They hoped that, with the aid of the people like Manuel, they may one day be able to transplant plants from other worlds and regreen the desolate surface. They live communally, with no concept of private property, Even children were raised in a communal nursery, with the community replacing the family unit as the core framework of their society. Physically, they were described as mostly human-looking, save for their oddly round black eyes. They had emotions, loved to play games, and never once displayed anything resembling anger, hatred, or any of humanity's other greatest hits. They were also vegetarian, and were absolutely enamored with stories of Earth animals for which they had no surviving corollary. While Clark was bursting with questions, the elderly Manuel was growing too tired to continue. However, before departing, Clark was first introduced to a young boy named Miguel. According to Manuel, he had been training the boy to take his place once he died. As it turned out, that day would come the following winter. He left all his possessions to Miguel's family to help pay for the boy's education. Among them was a mysterious box of gold bars, which a note claimed had been given to him by the Sky People in payment for services rendered. According to Miguel's mother, she used the money to send her son to an expensive boarding school, though perhaps Miguel is getting even more of an education than she had intended, as he had apparently begun to go missing for stretches of time, just as Manuel had.
God damn it, Sky People.
Yeah, and I do have to say one thing before we get to this, our first discussion question here. When I read about a guy in South America having a giant box of mystery gold, my first worry was that he helped Nazis.
Yeah, Nazis. Yeah, or it's like a family heirloom of like the Crusades kind of stuff.
Yeah, but rather than accuse the now deceased Manuel of aiding fascists, let's move to discussion question number one.
As you wish.
So one of the major themes we'll be hitting on in this episode is how anomalous experiences interface with or shape cultural beliefs and structures. The impact these experiences have on the Maya is and will be made clear, but one thing we have seldom discussed is the possible impact UFO shenanigans has had on our own culture. So, trying to see the forest through the trees, what, if any, impact do you believe the UFO phenomenon has had on North American culture?
So first and foremost, I just want to say that I think this is a great question.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I am fighting a demon in my throat today.
Ha! Ding.
Yeah, I got to work on that. My gag reflex, got to get rid of it. Otherwise, my bae Beelzebub is going to be a little angry.
I know some people that can help with that.
They're professionals.
I don't need to meet any more of your strange internet weirdos. They're a different kind of weirdo, a stickier kind.
That's funny. All right, but to the question. What impact do I believe the UFO phenomenon has had on North American culture? So North American as a whole, or just do we want to focus on America, the U.S. of A?
Wherever you want to go. I mean, I said North American just to differentiate it from South American because I couldn't just say American.
True.
But if you want to specifically dial down to USA or even Midwestern culture, that's fine.
Okay. I'll stick with the U.S. of A since that's what I know the most intimately here. But I think the UFO phenomenon is attempting to have a major impact on North American culture. I think it has had a significant impact on our culture. Everybody in the United States, everybody in the world knows what a UFO is. And this is large in part due to the UFO phenomenon in America.
Well, yeah, and it's even so much to the point that I've frequently heard, specifically, I've heard it a couple times in reference to Japanese culture, but a few other foreign cultures where UFOs are considered an American thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I think that there is a large impact, but I think that impact is attempting to become even larger through the modern day, especially because you've got so many people pushing for quote-unquote disclosure, which is a topic we've gone over and over on and is not worth diving into right now. But I think that there has been a huge impact, good or bad, on American culture, mostly. I think it's good.
Okay.
So something that Jay and I have actually talked about a lot over the recent weeks is this idea of like American, the USA culture. One of the biggest things about US culture is entertainment. We are, as Americans, entertainers, specifically though, cinema.
Well, yeah, it's one of our biggest exports.
Exactly. And it's something that I don't care who you are, but if you are a United States American, you care about the movie industry, you care about movies, and you probably had a small inkling to be an actor at one point in your life, or director, or be involved in that process.
I would even expand it to, I mean, movies are a big part of it, but now also we're seeing it in the small screen with television.
Oh, absolutely.
And also, I mean, I'd even put video games in that category, and comic books.
Absolutely. Comic books, I think that there's a whole nother separate, even larger discussion that we could have there about the impact that comics have had on American culture, but we don't...
Yeah, let's not excite Jay too much.
We literally just had a brief talk about this like yesterday. But anyway, but UFOs, aliens, and all of that is literally a subgenre of cinema at this point, of TV. Like, this is a thing that exists. And everybody knows it. And whether you believe in it in the reality or not, there are people that do. And it is overall had an incredible, culture shifting impact on America in one form or another.
Okay. Yeah.
In my opinion.
I think another really big impact that the UFO phenomenon has had on our culture is specifically on our conspiracy culture.
Yeah, that was the other thing I was thinking too. Yeah.
Like, so many of our conspiracies have elements of UFOs and aliens and ideas of alien technology and alien influence built into them. And it's interesting because I feel like in recent years, I've seen a conscious effort because, you know, as internet culture in America tries to become more socially conscious, people are becoming aware of things like anti-Semitic tropes and anti-Semitic propaganda. And I feel like I've noticed a conscious effort in recent years to take all of these conspiracies that at their root were trying to say Jewish people are evil and being like, let's just replace that with aliens. And now it's fine, right? Now it's fine. And a bunch of people are sitting there going, no, it's not. You're still spreading harmful. And it's like, yeah, but it's aliens now, so it's funny again. It's like, it's sometimes it's still not, though, dude. But yeah, I think the UFO phenomenon has in some ways contributed to the style of paranoia and obsessive overthinking that Americans in particular are prone to. And it's interesting because, Rory, I'm glad you brought up how it interacts with our cinema specifically, because I feel like we use UFOs and aliens in our movies and TV shows a lot to try and process our complicated and guilt complicated guilt and anxiety over colonialism and the genocide that our ancestors did a little bit, because so many of our alien movies and TV shows are basically just Americans saying, but what if someone did that to us though?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be awful? It's like, yeah, it would be.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking like even recent examples, the show, I mean, for the flaws the show has, the Invasion show on Apple.
Yep.
Does a pretty good job of that, of kind of just striking home the, almost faceless, cold evil kind of an invasion of like, these are beings coming who are taking this land who don't really see you as people even, let alone a threat. And kind of what is the horror of that?
Yeah. And that's kind of what I'm thinking of regardless of the phenomenon's physical or practical reality, it has had an undeniable influence over the way we process certain complicated feelings that we have as kind of a collective culture. And again, regardless of its practical reality, it We're clearly using it to talk about something in a way that's less scary than using the actual words that are attached to that, if that makes sense. And again, it's really interesting comparing that to Sky People, because it seems like our anxiety around this phenomenon is more intense, despite the fact that we believe in it less.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that. That's actually a really good point. Thinking about it, my first thought was, okay, well, UFOs, you know, around when they first started showing up, you know, we're entering into high technology. UFOs kind of help inspire science fiction, which in turn helps inspire science. You know, in a way, maybe that has been an impact on our trajectory as a people. Culturally, building on what you were saying there, Jay, one thing that I found interesting is this idea that, you know, you mentioned it there, how in modern conspiracy thought, aliens have become sort of the prime agent of the universe. Everything can be traced back to them or their unknowable agenda, right? And in a way, this seems like a post-Enlightenment version of a lot of older religious thought.
Yeah.
And in that UFOs have become the acceptable stand-in in the Age of Enlightenment for the agency that is beyond our control or understanding.
Yeah, and that's very in line with a lot of Jacques Vallée's work of boiling of, because a lot of his thesis statement in Passport to Magonia boiled down to, thank you, has been happening. This has been happening forever. We just call it different things and it shows up in different clothes. But this is very clearly just kind of the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, another thing that's interesting, this the idea that you hit upon of aliens are kind of used in our pop culture to explore our own guilt over what was done to indigenous peoples. Well, okay, now kind of broadening back, it almost seems if you now take the UFO phenomenon as a literal reality, that they exist, that they're out there. What if, in a way, at least on a pop cultural level, regardless of what they're actually doing, what they've done very subtly is not let us forget that guilt? Because, like, here is a, you know, we have all these ancient beliefs from that we're discussing in this book, the Maya people, the Native American people, about the Sky People, this ancient relationship they had with the universe and its denizens. What if these UFOs on a pop cultural level are kind of a reminder of that ancient wisdom of saying you didn't wipe out those relationships, you didn't wipe out those people, they're still there and you need to rectify with, you know, what you've done to them?
That is a distinct possibility. I am going to raise my objection to that stance that I always raise of it's just I never like the implication that we are so inherently bad that we need magic metaphysical hall monitors to tell us when we've done something wrong.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not even talking about that's why the UFOs are there, what's they're doing. I'm thinking psychologically, as a culture, seeing them as kind of almost a reminder of what we destroyed.
Yeah, and I kind of think that's what it is that it's almost like it's us bringing it up over and over again of like, hey, but this bothers me. This thing that you kind of hid from me for the first 25 years of my life until I went to a high enough level of education that I got taught the actual truth about the settlement of this continent. Like, it's bothering me that this happened and you're expecting me to be okay with it. And it's bothering me so much that I'm going to make 14 movies throughout my life about how much this is bothering me.
Yeah. Well, and I think, yeah, I don't know. I think there's something there, definitely. I think on a pop cultural level, the UFO mythos is innately tied in, at least in North America, with our own, with really the conquest of the land we now live on. Because ultimately, ultimately, it seems that, at least the implication is in this book, that a lot of the truth of that unknowable mystery that we're always grasping at, whether through religion or ufology or whatever, it's not that those are ungraspable. It's that we killed all the people who could grasp it and could have taught us.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what, I think it was Rodrigo who was saying that, like, all the wise men of his culture are gone, like the real wise men that had the actual sacred knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, and it was just, it's just like, yeah, they just, you know, sometimes traditions, especially when they've been affected by colonialism, they just don't fucking make it. It sometimes just goes away.
Yep. All right. Well, I think we beat that one to death. Are we ready for part two?
Yes.
Part two. One very extended family. Clark continued to gather UFO stories at each stop she made. From a waiter who had lost time following a roadside encounter with a Tic Tac UFO and its chameleon-skinned occupants, to a local shaman who reported encountering the mythical red-eyed woman of stone who visited ancient Maya temples upon a beam of light and who could paralyze witnesses at a glance.
Overpowered.
But eventually, her time in Belize came to an end, and she moved on to the much less fruitful country of Honduras. Continuing along in Stephen and Catherwood's footsteps, she next made her way to Cope and Ruinous, where she and Buddy parted ways. She soon fell in love with the poor yet vibrant town, built in the shadow of ancient Maya monuments. However, it came with a new challenge. The people of this community were professional gossips, and word of her appearance and her interest in UFOs spread quickly. Where in Belize she had found no end to UFO witnesses dying to share their story, here everyone clammed up, seemingly fearful that their own strange encounter would soon become fodder for the endless rumor mill. As such, the few witnesses she did speak to while in the country only did so under the condition of strict anonymity. The first stories she gathered were familiar to us in the north. Stories of cattle mutilations, encounters with black-eyed visitors, witnesses losing time and experiencing total paralysis, and other hallmarks of the prototypical UFO soup. However, amidst these stories, she encountered others which seemed to hint at a deeper connection between the Maya people and the visitors from the stars. A kilometer away from the ruins of Copan lay Las Sepulturas, connected to the ancient city by an equally ancient stone walkway. There, while touring the ruins, she met a 99-year-old man by the name of Luis Santiago, who lived in one of the nearby indigenous Maya villages. He was also an expert on the ruins, as he'd been assisting foreign researchers excavating the site for over 75 years, starting when he was a boy when he and his friends would attempt to find Maya artifacts to sell to the archaeologists for a quick buck. During one such trip, when he was 11 or 12, he and his friends investigated an old cavern nearby where they discovered a silver man from beyond the stars. It was a skeleton, about 3 feet tall and dressed in a silver suit. Lying nearby, they found a strange tablet covered with an unknown script, which the archaeologists, once the boys led them to the site, were unable to identify. The researchers were obviously in a state of deep excitement, and one even told Santiago that this may once and for all prove a connection between the Maya people and the stars. However, in the end, nothing seemed to come of this. The body was shipped off to the U.S., where it was never heard from again. And for his find, Santiago and his cousins were paid a whole $2, about $70 U.S. today. For his part, Santiago voiced a deep guilt over his actions as a boy. Quote, "For some reason, I think we knew we had given up an important part of our history. Only the scientists who took it away knew the truth, and they are not talking. Your government probably knows, too. I think our government knows, but they do not want to admit it to us simple people. But our people know far more than the governments about the men from the stars." And given what Clark herself would soon see in Cope and Ruinous, he may have been correct. Cope and Ruinous is a massive complex of ancient Maya temples and monuments, which, in UFO lore, has the distinction of being home to a key piece of evidence in the ancient astronaut theory. In 1968, Swiss author Enrique von Daniken published the classic UFO book and shining example of colonial thought distortions, Chariots of the Gods. In this book, he argued that the ancient Maya civilization, and most other ancient civilizations, were built with the aid of space aliens. As support for his theory, he pointed to certain engravings which seemed to show a Maya king riding inside some sort of a spacecraft, along with the implicit understanding that such, quote, savage and uncultured people couldn't possibly have built massive empires to rival the greatest achievements of Europe.
Brave, brave listeners. If you learn nothing else from this podcast, this is the one thing I need you to internalize. Anytime a person is pointing at an ancient culture, particularly an ancient culture whose people are different color than that person, and says they couldn't possibly build. Actually, no, I'm not going to do that voice. That's classes. They could not possibly have built this mighty thing, for they were simple and did not know the joys of peanut butter and gasoline. How could they have possibly constructed it? That's always racist. Anyone who is saying that ever is being racist. And if you're sitting there going, Jay, but some of these questions are legitimately unanswered. Well, you don't get to be racist just because the problem is difficult.
I like how,
all right?
I like how, because you didn't want to be classist, you instead decided to insult all the fake phony British lords out there.
I don't know what that voice was that I was doing.
doing the voice that we do for my cat, Watson.
You know, I love Watson, but I feel like Watson sometimes gets sucked into the ancient astronaut theory because the Easter Island heads freak him out too much.
No, Watson would be, if he could speak, probably would be a stodgy British racist.
And speaking of which, the Easter Island heads, we know how those got there now. The people of that island used rope contraptions to essentially rock the statues back and forth, guided by one person on either side, and they literally walked them from carving sites to the sites where they were mounted. And I think that's probably something similar to what they did with these pillars, is they probably walked them.
It's the same thing I do when I'm moving furniture I can't lift.
Yeah.
Yes!
It's the same shit that they probably did with a lot of the rocks for the pyramids. It's the same shit that they did for a lot of the stones around Stonehenge.
Yeah, and we also have a pretty good theory about what they did for the giant stones with the pyramids, too. It was a combination of laying down long lines of essentially wooden rods that they rolled them across, and they slicked the sand with water.
Yep. Made it a little wet.
Yep. And for a long time, here's the thing, is Egyptologists saw the water pouring depicted in hieroglyphics and murals, and they couldn't figure out what it was for, and they kept saying, oh, it's superstitious, religious, ceremonial purposes. And then they asked a couple of rural Egyptian farmers that don't have access to industrial equipment and need to do construction projects with what they have at hand. They just, for the first time in 150 years, were like, hey, what about asking the people who live there? And the people immediately said, yeah, you pour the water on the sand before you put it on the wooden rods to make it move better.
Yep.
Is that fun? But yeah, so the pillars, I think maybe they probably just walked them.
Yep. Though perhaps Daniken was closer to some real truth than anyone could have guessed. While local Maya were none too fond of Daniken's theory, the truth is that Copan Ruinous does seem to have a connection to the Sky People. As Clark too learned when she was approached by a housekeeper at her hotel, an indigenous Maya woman who had heard of her interest in UFOs. Like most witnesses she encountered, the housekeeper was fascinated with Clark's heritage as a native of North America, and hence decided that she could be trusted with privileged information about what the Maya knew about their ancient ruins. According to her, the ruins were often visited by the Old Ones, a race of extraterrestrial who were directly related to the Maya by blood. They only came at night and would only show themselves to indigenous people. These visitors, whom she often addressed as ancestors, came in many forms. Sometimes they are humanoid. Sometimes they come in the form of spacecraft, and sometimes they eschew all physicality and manifest as living balls of light. And supposedly, these ancestors were planning on meeting Clark personally. A local shaman in the woman's village had a vision, and it said that an indigenous woman would soon arrive from the north, and that would be an omen of a coming time of prosperity. It seemed that everyone in the village had already concluded that Clark was the one foretold. The housekeeper arranged to have Clark meet her brother, Teodoro, at midnight. Thereupon, she'd be taken into the ancient city to fulfill the shaman's vision. At the appointed time, Teodoro arrived and, brandishing lantern and machete, led her into the jungle. He led her down a well-hidden jungle path until she began to notice an odd purplish light ahead of them. What she initially assumed to be a lantern soon split into several small orbs of light, which darted amidst the trees. These, Teodoro explained, were the Old Ones in energetic form. The orbs soon departed, and then they continued onwards towards the ruin, where Teodoro led her up the steps to the top of the largest temple. They waited in the dark, neither speaking nor moving for close to 3 hours. Just as Clark was about to drift to sleep, Teodoro announced that they are here. Clark looked down and, to her amazement, saw several small balls of light dancing across the plaza below. One of the arms flew upwards, stopping level with Clark. A moment later, the rest rose up as well, fell into formation, and then dispersed. According to Teodoro, the ancestors had assessed her and determined that she was one of us. They remained until dawn when, as if the night had not been exciting enough, she had another sighting. In the sky above appeared a large, circular, wheel-like craft. She watched, speechless, as it flew off into the eastern sky. According to Teodoro, this visit had been important, and she had somehow restored a balance long disturbed. He escorted her back to the hotel, where she was to meet the guide for the next leg of her journey, a master's-level anthropologist and historian named Mateo Huertas Rios, who took jobs driving for tourists in the summer. As they drove away together, heading towards the Guatemalan border, he asked her if she'd seen the news the previous night. A massive UFO had been spotted above Copan Ruinas.
God, I love Mateo.
Yeah, Mateo's great. They continued on into Guatemala, collecting stories along the way. One such early encounter was with a Maya elder named Romero, whom she met through her driver. They met in a small cafe where, after some small talk, Romero began to further explain the connections between the Maya people and the Sky people. According to him, and several other witnesses and elders she spoke with on her journey, the most ancient Maya stories indicate that the Maya people were not from this world at all. They too came from the stars and had been led to Earth by their ancestors among the Sky people. Initially, they took Mexico to be their home until Spanish invaders forced them into the Guatemalan jungle. It was during this time of upheaval that a key Maya artifact was either destroyed, stolen, or otherwise lost. The star map. As Romero explained, the Maya people once had in their possession a map which somehow facilitated travel among the stars. It was also how they knew of the cosmos, from the Big Bang to the planetary orbits, to other revelations that had only recently been confirmed by modern science. When it was lost, likely destroyed by the Catholic Church as a pagan heresy, the Maya people became truly stranded on Earth. Though that isn't to say that they're alone. Their ancestral chants can still call the Sky people to seek wisdom and aid. In fact, according to Romero, Mateo, and several other Maya elders, the Maya language is the language of their ancestors from the sky. The Sky people sometimes take wise men and leaders, like Romero, to pass along warnings. Most recently, he had been told many times of a coming cataclysm on Earth. When that time comes, he was told that the Maya would be spared, rescued from their imperiled world by their distant cousins from the stars. The details of this cataclysm, like many UFO prophecies, were vague. He believed they would have to do with a great volcano opening up between North and South America. He also claimed that the, at the time, looming Maya doomsday of 2012 would not in fact be the end of the world, but would be the beginning of a time of great difficulty, which would culminate in utter destruction. And given how the last 9 years have gone on planet Earth, I wonder if he may have been right. What he was sure of was that the Maya would eventually return to Earth to rebuild and try again. For the rest, their destiny lay in new homes across the stars. Which brings us to our second discussion question. So, we have discussed the ancient astronaut theory before and the great potential for racism that's baked into it. However, here we have Maya elders presenting us with a new version of the ancient astronaut theory, and so I want us to explore it for a moment. What do you like about this idea? What doesn't line up for you? And do you think this model is as open to exploitation and abuse by racists as is the modern ancient astronaut hypothesis?
So that is a complicated question because, yes, it is definitely vulnerable to exploitation by racists within the ancient astronaut community. And by and large, every example I've seen of ancient astronaut shit from Western culture has read as deeply racist to me. Like, pretty much all of it that I can literally think of. So I can definitely see the issue of this encouraging that rhetoric, but at the same time, it would be complete and utter bullshit to be like, you have to abandon one of the ancient traditions of your severely marginalized culture, just because racists may take it out of context and exploit it. Like, that's not only ludicrous, that's a form of victim blaming. And it's also one of those things where the Maya are, like, obviously every culture is unique, but that kind of element of the idea of, well, our people didn't come from here, we're special and different, and our gods or forebearers or whatever brought us here from somewhere else because we're special and different. That's not, they are not quite the only culture in the world that has a belief like that. And in terms of, like, my comfort level or my opinion on it, I just have to turn back to the training that I had, that I received in undergrad, about respecting the reality of someone else's cosmology. Of that is as true as it needs to be, because that is the story of your culture and that is the lens through which you understand the world and your place in it. So as long as your beliefs are not somehow causing me direct measurable harm, who gives a fuck what I think about it, and who gives a fuck how it fits in with my cosmology? This is only gonna become an active question for me if I, for some reason, divorce Rory, marry a Maya person, and integrate into this community. Like, that's the only scenario in which I can see this becoming a day-to-day question I'm gonna have to wrestle with in my life. For right now, it's like, that's a thing I am grateful to know about your culture, because I feel like it's going to allow me to understand certain discussions better and bring a more multi-layered perspective to elements of this discussion. But, like, you know, if I'm remembering right, one of the Egyptian origin myths about where human beings came from is like, yeah, one time Sekhmet got fucking hammered and killed so many monsters and beasts that the blood soaked the sands of Egypt, and Ra had to create humans out of the congealed mess. Like, you know, what? Neat. Like, that's fantastic.
What else am I gonna do with all this blood?
It doesn't have shit to do with me. You know, I'm trying, it's like, you know, according to, you know, my culture of being an American, it's just like, you know, Jesus sneezed me into existence because we're so awesome. Like, that's what I've been told, more or less. So circling back to the actual meat of the question, of course that myth can be exploited by racists, but it's not the responsibility of the Maya people to prevent racists from exploiting it. If it's anybody's responsibility, it's kind of ours to be like, hey, asshole, I know just enough about that thing you're citing to tell you that you are taking it wildly out of context, and you need to knock it off, because their cultural myths that they are fighting day by day to preserve do not deserve to be reduced to a bullet point on your Reddit thread about why the Roswell crash definitely happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So overall, I would say that I agree with your assessment, Jay, but to, I guess, add on to it, I think that, so for whether or not this is open for exploitation, yeah, I agree. Yes, obviously, it could be fuel for the Nazi fire.
Well, I mean, my big concern would be, in the wrong hands, you could take this and go, well, they're not humans, so they don't have rights.
Right.
They're not like the rest of us. They're so special, that means they don't get all the human rights. Like, yeah. That'd be the horrible argument that I could see certain people adopting based off this.
I could also see people saying, using it as fuel for proving their version of this story as true. because they can sit there and point and be like, look, even the Mayans have a story like this, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though one of them is, you know, pushing a story of racism and whatever, whereas the other is, you know, just a mythological story of a people. So, but like this, I feel like even putting this under the umbrella of the ancient astronaut hypothesis is almost disingenuous to what this story actually is, because this isn't, to me, like looking at it, and to probably a lot of the Mayan people, this isn't a story about extraterrestrials and us. This is the story of their creation.
Right.
This is a story, or this is a story of creation. So, like they may say, like the entities may say they're coming from the stars, because that's the framework that the people can understand. But ultimately, I feel like the story is much more akin to Adam and Eve than ancient world order.
Yeah.
You know, because like I said, I think that this is more of a creation story, whereas Len Kasten's story was a story of one nation's power over another nation. This story is in a lot of ways saying how they, their people came to be here on this planet. And for all we know, this is just yet another story to explain how they're perceiving these altered terrestrials, or how they're perceiving themselves through creation.
It could also in some ways be like, I think we talked about before that theory that the bacteria that eventually evolved into all life on Earth may have come from an asteroid mm-hmm. that crashed here. And, you know, we know that traumatic experiences change your DNA and create a sort of quote unquote genetic memory that gets mm-hmm. passed down to your descendants. It's like, on some level, somehow, do we kind of know? If that is true, that we came originally from bacteria that was attached to an asteroid that crashed here, do we kind of know a little bit? And do we keep making up stories to talk about that?
We feel that desire to go back to the stars, because that's where we came from, is the stars.
Louis C.K., who is a gross person, a long time ago had a bit about, he's like, I don't think humans are from this planet, because have you noticed we don't like it? Have you noticed we keep doing things to change it, where we're like, dirt, we're going to build a sterile white box to live in because we don't want to deal with the dirt, and I don't like the temperature the air is. I'm going to build poisonous machines to change the temperature the air is, and no, I'm not going to eat the stuff that's growing out of the ground. I'm going to crush it up to make it into chocolate, and then I'm going to dip bacon in that chocolate, and don't ask me about bacon. It's a whole other process. Like, it's just... Like, I think about that sometimes, of like, wow, we sometimes don't seem entirely well suited to life here. Like, every time this planet does something, we scream, no! And we throw things at it until it stops doing that.
If you look back, our key adaptation that allowed us to take over the planet was entirely endurance, which means that our power, our genuine superpower, is humanity is just that guy who's too angry to die.
Which, yeah.
And that would make sense if we evolved originally from bacteria that was tough enough to survive passing through our atmosphere and landing in our ocean, which at the time was a toxic hellscape. It was mostly sulfur, and anything that wasn't sulfur was straight up acid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think I agree. I mean, I think that like anything, a bad actor with bad intentions can twist it towards bad ends. But that's true, sadly, about any story, any ideology. Yeah. If someone's not going to act in good faith, there's, you know, you could do whatever you want with it. I will say there are certain logical issues with the story. which I do want to address kind of more in depth on our next episode, but specifically, all right, the Maya people, if they came from the stars, they're direct descendants. If we're going to take that as literal gospel truth, they are blood relatives to a species of extraterrestrial. That opens up questions. Why aren't they that genetically different from the rest of humanity? Where did the rest of humanity come from? Were we also from another type of sky people, or the same type? But if so, when did, say, Europeans lose that relationship that with the sky ancestors? So, I mean, I think that the reason all those contradictions are there is, A, because you're taking what is ultimately a very personal cultural story and trying to fit it into a larger mythic MCU. But beyond that, I think it's also because I think that, like most ancient stories, they're and not just reading it allegorically, but even if you were to say this is their best attempt at explaining what happened, that might not be the truth, the full reality of it. I'm thinking things like, you know, more spiritual dimensions, supernatural kind of stuff. Basically, those ineffable elements of the phenomenon that we continually try to grasp at, that if those are involved, what we could be seeing is ultimately an interpretation of something that is still, even to them, beyond the hardware that we have in our skulls, beyond the ability of that hardware to really grasp what's going on, because maybe it's happening in the fourth and fifth dimension or something like that.
The way that I kind of saw it, like an equivalency, I guess, is like the Mayan people to the sky people is to the Celts to the Tutha Dedana.
Very much so.
Yeah.
All right. Are we ready for the third and final part of this episode?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's go.
Also, I looked it up. Humans were not made out of blood from that time that Sekhmet got drunk. They were made out of tears of happiness from Shu and Tefnut.
No, that's lame. I want to be blood.
Blood.
Nope. Tears of happiness, and also they made us before they made the sun and the moon.
More blood. Blood. Blood.
Tears!
Blood.
Part three, the others.
The others, blood.
God damn it.
This is what happens when you have Muppet time at the beginning of the episode.
Muppet time!
Evil blue-skinned giants aside, you may think, given the overall tone of the stories we've heard thus far, that the Mesoamerican UFO story is blissfully lacking in the usual fare of horrifying abductions and encounters with predatory malevolence. However, as many elders made clear to Clark, that is sadly far from the truth. While the local Maya often rely on their sky ancestors for protection and aid, they are far from the only game in town. And as Clark delved deeper into Guatemala, she was soon confronted with a nightmarish parade of extraordinary abductions, violations, and supposed encounters with these others. Shortly after a visit to the ancient city of Quiragua, where she recorded a story from a first-hand witness of one family's abduction and return by blue-skinned others, her driver Mateo called to tell her that his sister wanted to meet her for dinner. This would give Clark the chance to meet Mateo's nieces, whom, he promised, had recently had an encounter she'd want to hear. That night, she met the three nieces and their cousin, Itzel, Emma, Ichtel, and Akna. The four of them had been out late one Saturday 3 weeks prior, and were walking back home sometime around midnight. As they passed a field, Akna saw four figures moving about, and assumed that they were local boys preparing to prank the group. She called to them, and a moment later, Emma screamed. All four suddenly found themselves paralyzed, and were forced to merely watch as four humanoid figures emerged into the light. They were described as tall, skinny, and bony. They wore shiny, single-piece suits with empty belts slung across their narrow waists. Most striking was their eyes, which glowed a bright red. Assuming they were devils, the girls screamed in unison, and then the paralysis broke. They ran, and as they did, a circular craft kept pace with them from above before shooting off into the sky and vanishing. All four girls had the distinct impression that these entities had intended to abduct them. Even more concerning, Akna reported feeling that they had somehow been messing with her brain, and that when she initially saw them, she was almost convinced that they were in fact the local boys that she'd initially assumed them to be. It was only her terror which allowed her to override the suggestion and see them as they truly were. Clark stayed with Mateo's sister's family that night. The next morning, Mateo suggested they hang around until the regular vegetable delivery, as the delivery man also had a story she may want to hear. Soon after, she met the man himself, Hector, and with Mateo translating, recorded his story. As he explained, 2 years prior, he had been doing field work with his brother. As the day was drawing to a close, both brothers noticed that it was growing strangely warmer. Soon after, they saw an object appear hovering above the nearby tree line. Described as a rusty brown flying saucer, the craft lowered itself to the ground, whereupon a small man emerged and floated the rest of the way to the earth. The visitor was odd and moved in stiff, herky-jerky motions. The brothers assumed it was a demon, and if it was, it can only be because the devil was planning movie night and needed some extra fresh popcorn so he could enjoy Madame Web. The small man harvested, read, stole, several ears of the brothers' corn. Hector's brother, unwilling to take such casual crime sitting down, leapt out. They chased the demon all the way back to its craft, where the brothers suddenly became paralyzed. The demon and its craft left, but it would be several hours before either brother had the strength to walk home. In fact, both soon became gravely ill and spent days puking and thrashing in bed. Hector's brother developed a mysterious rash, which defied modern medicine and was only cured after the intercession by a local Maya shaman. While Clark privately suspected these maladies were due to radiation exposure, Hector firmly believes that it was a curse, one you can only get by looking the visitors in the eyes. Their gaze, he believed, was poison. Sticking near Mateo's village, Clark was next taken to meet Chok Took, a Maya elder who had his own terrifying encounter with the others during his boyhood.
He's an icon.
The event itself happened. I love that name, Chok Took. The event itself happened in 1957, when he was 12 years old. Chok Took had been sleeping in a hammock in his backyard when he was awoken by a bright light, the same relative size as the moon, which dropped from the sky and came to rest in a nearby jungle. Soon a posse formed, and armed with machetes, they went to investigate. Almost immediately, the group noticed an odd, sickly sweet smell in the air. They pressed on for over an hour, despite the gag-inducing stench, until they were close enough to see the glow of the object through the trees. Before they could go any further, a pair of burning red eyes suddenly appeared from the shadows before them, accompanied by a low hissing noise. One man held up a lantern to reveal a glimpse of a reptilian humanoid. Its skin was greenish-brown, perfect camouflage for the jungle around it. It was also larger than a man, with considerable muscle and what appeared to be thick scales. Before they could see it in any greater detail, the creature leapt up into the trees. At that moment, everyone in the party felt suddenly very dizzy and grew ill. That horrible smell intensified, and so they returned home and, for the most part, acted like none of it had ever happened. There seemed to be a common contention that if they spoke too much about what they'd seen, it would cause the creature to come again. And while Chok Took clearly didn't share that concern, he did believe that the creature could have killed and devoured them all without much effort. Since then, he has seen the lights in the sky many times, but has never again gone to investigate. In his estimation, once was more than enough.
Why the fuck do you park here every time you need to reboot the navigation system? There are people right the fuck over there, and they don't come in here anymore, do they, Denise? I told you if we scare them once, they'll leave us alone forever.
They're taking photos. I can hear the clicking.
Listen, Reptibob, we've been parking here for a while, and we're getting complaints from the locals. You really need to take a bath. This is getting out of hand. It's fine. It's fine when you go to your D&D conventions, but not here in the jungle. You gotta bathe for the jungle.
I'm trying to break the galaxy record for going the longest without a bath.
Like, bitch, you stink!
Like my father before me!
You broke the record 6 months ago. Go take a bath.
I don't want some upstart beating my record.
Your dick cheese is gaining sentience. Get in the shower!
No!
But who exactly are these interlopers? What do they want? And what are they... God damn
Your
it.
Dick cheese is gaining sentience.
God damn it.
You're the one that said it.
I know, but then what I said echoed back across my thoughts, and I realized I said it aloud.
You said it into a microphone. It's recording. This is going to go on Spotify. It's not going to be behind a paywall or anything. People can just hear that whenever they want. Some intrepid asshole's going to make it his fucking ringtone.
Because he likes to live in 2002?
Yes, I mean, I do.
But who exactly are these interlopers? What do they want? And what do they have to do with those the Maya call sky people? While we may never know the full answer, Clark did uncover some suggestions during an unexpected encounter with a Maya elder named Yok. Yuck lived alone in a small shack beside a set of unmarked and largely unexcavated Maya ruins. He'd originally come to assist government plans to excavate the site. When those plans fell through, Yuck chose to remain to ensure the out-of-the-way ruin was not once again forgotten to time. In exchange for lunch, Yuck took Clark on a tour of the few visible ruins, among which was the remains of a small temple. Like many ancient sites found throughout the world, the doorway of the temple was covered with a large number of paintings of red handprints. For decades, scholars have long argued over the meaning of these ancient symbols, with theories ranging from them being part of a religious rite to being the equivalent of artist's signatures left by the builders. None of these are true, according to Yuck. These are, rather, the signature of the shining people of the Red Hand. They are the sky gods, the ones that once led the Maya to this planet and now who come to check in on their descendants. As he explained, there were many kinds of sky people, but only these ones were connected to the Maya. During his own, largely unexplained, encounter with the Shining Ones, Yuck was told of 67 inhabited solar systems, which belonged to a confederation of races. Earth, not yet advanced enough for membership, was nonetheless visited by hundreds of craft every single day, the majority of which we simply don't have the technology to perceive. Many of these belong to the Shining Ones. They come to watch over mankind, to help guide us, and ultimately to try and help our leaders work towards world peace. However, they aren't the most attentive of babysitters. Rather, they come in 16-year cycles, being the amount of time it takes for one group to go back to their home world and another to be dispatched.
That's 4 presidential elections!
Meaning he expected their return by 2016. Ooh, bad timing.
Yeah, no shit.
Needless to say, long enough for a cosmic dingo to come and make off with toddler humanity. The Shining Ones, he continued, look human when not in energetic or UFO form. They live for 800 years, and supposedly have passed the secrets of this longevity, and how to cure all illnesses, onto our scientists who have simply chosen not to use it. If such a cure-all exists, it is no doubt rotting in a shoebox beneath some pharma executive's bed.
This is where it's this kind of shit, like when they say shit like this, that makes me just take so much, like, this is probably terrible. But take so much of what they said, literally everything they said, I just put it into a pile and then I throw it in the trash.
That I had a similar experience because that is one of those things where it's like, dude, that is...
It's a level of conspiracy that can't exist.
Yes, of it's just like, and I want to make statements like that. I want to make the person issuing the statement expand on it a little bit of, what do you mean they've shared it with... the scientists, right. Capital T, capital S. Which scientists? And did you give them this cure in a form that they could comprehend, let alone distribute? Like,
oh, they just handed a crystal to Henry Ford and called it good.
Yeah. Henry Ford isn't a scientist. He was an industrialist. And
he's got machines and gears and stuff. That's science-y, right?
He was an anti-Semite, which is the opposite of being scientific.
What the fuck is a Semite?
just staring at this reptilian like, look, the point, but yeah, like you said, Rory, it's one of those things where it's like, and we are beyond my capacity of belief. That is just not, that's not how people work. If you, like, no matter how desperately we want to make money, we want our children to not die of polio more.
Yeah.
So I'm really sorry that because the third question is going to ask us to entertain his theory here.
I mean, that's fine.
So to a Western eye, all this talk of space confederacies and other worlds would imply a strictly materialist, physicalist interpretation of the UFO phenomenon. However, as we encounter both here and in other texts we've covered, to many indigenous people, the divide between spiritual and physical is much thinner, if it exists at all. So let's try to step beyond the distinction. Is there a way we can understand Yuck's story about a space confederacy made up of representatives of various solar systems while still maintaining the spiritual or magical elements which seem to be inherent to the Maya view of the sky people?
I think that you can. I think you can to an extent. There are many people who believe that Jesus was a real person. There's evidence to suggest that he might be.
Right.
They worship him like a god. It's not different, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
assuming that he was real and that he went beyond this physical form and now he is something more. Sure. I don't see much different there than treating people that they see as greater as godlike deities or something akin to that from a spiritual perspective. That being said, I think that the physicality of it does make it harder for others from an outside perspective to see it as anything other than materialist physicalist interpretation. And they won't see the spiritual side. They won't care to see it. And that just like with any aspect of the UFO phenomenon, those, for the most part, I'll say, those that are stuck in the materialist, physicalist interpretation don't engage with the woo, period.
Right. I think that's probably the biggest disservice of a strict materialist interpretation is, it's never sat right with me, the audacity of saying all these thousands of years of human thought and belief, because that doesn't match my modern understanding of the universe, is irrelevant. I will only pick out the bits that support my current theory.
Yeah.
And ignore the cultural and I even say mystical context.
Yeah.
That a lot of those stories were placed in.
But I do want to talk about this space confederacy thing, because this is something we've read about multiple times where people talk about these global groups, or not global, but
galactic
groups that are whatever. I mean, just the other day, an article dropped about a mothership is in our solar system. Is from, I think that was from Avi Loeb or whatever. I don't remember the whole fucking details behind it, because I'm 90% sure it was being taken out of context for what the article was referencing. But nonetheless, these kind of things we hear about all the time. But I want to, I want to challenge these ideas. Why do we think that there is some galactic republic group of many different types of alien species that all are waiting for us to become ready?
As above, so below. We have the UN here on Earth, so obviously there has to be space UN, because why would up there be different than here?
I guess that's kind of my point. You know, it's something we've talked about all the time. It's like we continuously project these human ideas and human things onto these non-human entities as if it's something that they would just naturally do. But if they're beyond us, if they're more than us, why would they do it the same way we would? Why would it be identical, or whatever?
Right.
I struggle with this idea because it just doesn't really make much sense to me. With the data and understanding of the universe as we know it, the odds of a planet being able to bear life are slim to none. Right? It's very, 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 very hard for a planet to be able to grow like ours. Right?
I'll say this. I'll put the caveat on there of life as we know it. For all we know, there could be life out there that feeds on acid or something like that, or can live in those other extreme environments.
Life as science can, as we understand science,
yep.
Which, based on the evidence that we have, is the only way that life can form.
Yep. Because we have one planet as our sample size.
Correct. And we've explored other planets in a sense, right? We have seen them, we've witnessed them, and these ones don't have life that we've seen. But my point is, why do we think there's so many? And we know that there's no planet close to us that has any life, or at least that we've seen. Why do we think that they're fucking coming here, all of them, and watching us? other than, yeah, okay, there is life here, so they're watching it. But I still struggle with the idea that they're even able to get here from a materialist physical point of view.
So my brain just went off in a direction. Why are they all watching us? Because it's just so goddamn sexy. We're just waiting for us to come of age, and then we're going to become the galaxy's biggest brothel.
I mean, like, I want to be the prettiest girl at the ball, too, but I really don't think that we're that special.
Turns out it is just, like, an extended gag. Like, they're going to tell us we're the prettiest, and then when we're all out there ready to, like, receive galactic glory, they're just going to dump pig's blood on us like Carrie.
Yeah, I feel like that's the joke. We are the butt end of the joke here.
Maybe. God, I hope. No, that's sad. No, I think I largely agree with many of your points there. I think one thing that I will say this, one thing I struggle with the Confederacy thing and the whole idea of like Galactic Union is that almost always the source of this is a contactee or someone is told this. And I'm not even ignoring the contact, you know, if there are contactees out there who make up their story, which sadly there are. But even if those all happen exactly as they said, I really keep coming back to, well, why are we trusting the people who are telling them this? And because we don't know what they are, what their intention is, or any of that. We do not know.
Mm-hmm.
We may have some hints in ancient culture, but I mean, if they're that much advanced, they could have been lying this whole time. And I also got to think, if I, going to your, Jay, your drunk teenagers thing. All right, I'm a drunk teenager. I'm flying mom's UFO and I shouldn't be. I crash it on a world covered in war apes who are three times my size. What do you think I'm going to tell them? That I'm here alone and I shouldn't be here? Or I'm going to say I'm a representative of a vast consortium of unimaginable power?
You know, that's a really good point. What if they just lie?
Or panic? What if it's a panic response?
That's what I've kind of been wondering. Because I know I'm still anthropomorphizing and looking through a human lens and yada, 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 yada. Reddit, I know, okay? I fucking know. But fucking bear with me. Their weird-ass behavior, does it just not make more sense if you look at them from the perspective of they are 17, they are a little high, they are lost, they are trying not to get in more trouble than they already are. Those fucking ant aliens in the Trinity book, how do you explain this other than they are 17, a little high, and they don't know where they are?
You know, and even if you want to go past, like, drunk teenagers, I mean, okay, what if we've also heard numerous times, we're going to take all these claims at face value, we've also heard numerous times that Earth is under a quarantine of some kind. No, we're not, you know, the whole first contact thing, we're supposed to be insulated from that till we're ready and all that. What if every encounter has been with criminals? The criminals of those societies, people who are the rule breakers, who are more likely to lie.
I seriously believe that, like, fuck it, like, in this book that we were just reading, the boy, Diego, that lets her into that site that at the time was closed to the public. What if so many of the encounters that we're having are people who ducked under the keep out tape and are just wandering around Earth? Because again, UFOs over the White House, that really weird encounter that woman had where the UFO just kept flashing different colored lights and smoke at her, like it was just watching her reaction. Sometimes I sometimes, reading these stories, feel like a baby tiger cub and an ill-informed tourist is going, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, as it's feeding me popcorn out of its open hand. Again, doesn't some of this behavior make more sense if we are baby tiger cubs being fed popcorn by an excited tourist?
Here's the thing. If it turns out that the UFOs or whatever are treating us as such, I will accept it on one condition and one condition only. One, my one condition.
Yes.
Is that they actually bring me popcorn because I really like popcorn.
I will also accept head scritches. Those are damn good.
You know what? If Jay would allow it, I would accept head scratches as well.
Wash your hands first, and then yes, we will accept head scratches.
Excellent. Oh, all the little suckers on their fingers got rid of my dandruff.
Ooh,
that would be great. Can they heal my dry scalp?
And those cube aliens in
Northern Lights.
Yeah, Northern Lights. When they went to visit the guy at the
the radio tower or whatever.
It,
yeah,
it really felt like them going, he has a little radio station.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh!
I will trade you your alien popcorn for this cardboard suit.
That's our job in the future. Tailors to the stars.
Yeah.
But yeah. So this sort of like, and I mean, and again, it's, you know how sometimes with little kids they're asking really difficult questions, and you don't want to tell them a lie, but their brains and their emotional processing just cannot deal with the actual reality. And so you have to coach things in specific terms so that it's easier to process. And then later, when they have more context, more understanding, and also their souls and brains are just physically ready, like, it's entirely possible that what they're telling us from that materialist shit, it's possible it's not lies so much as like, no, I wasn't lying to you. It's just you were asking questions, and they were really good questions. And I wanted to, I'm not going to not answer your question. That's condescending as shit. And I'm trying to build a relationship here, but I also needed to put this in terms that you were actually going to be able to grasp, and I had to get a little creative. Like,
I just got the image of these aliens totally like being like doing the southern thing to us with that, oh, you sweet summer child,
bless your heart.
Yeah. You're trying to understand the nature of the universe, but in reality, you can't know.
Well, I mean, because imagine if there are races out there. Yeah, you were born on a planet just like us, and you grow and you die just like us, but your brain innately operates in the fourth dimension. Mm-hmm. So you traveling through time is like walking between rooms. Like, could that a species like that actually fully explain their situation to us?
No.
In a way we'd understand? It'd be
tough. Yeah. No. It's like trying to explain our reality in our way, just talking to a dog.
Right. And imagine if it goes further than that. Imagine a species out there that for some reason evolved to perceive and interact with six dimensions. We don't even know what two of those are.
Yeah.
One of them is purple. The other is the entire concept of freeform jazz.
Ah, we're scatting everywhere.
I love that. So according to our current science, I don't understand how this works, by the way, but according to the article I just read, we're fairly sure there are 11 dimensions to reality. Mm. And I swear to God, if at the end of humans' development we find out one of those, a true constant of the universe, is freeform solo jazz, I am going to self-immolate instantly.
And I'll stop you with jazz magic.
God damn it. The true song of the universe, the harmony of the spheres written about by ancient occultists for thousands of years, is just God scatting.
Miles Davis rises from the grave for one afternoon to sit on CNN and laugh for 16 hours.
Okay, I think we're
done.
I think we're done. I think we're done because I don't know what's about to happen in this room, but it might get violent. So we should probably
Muppet time.
Oh, God. Just randomly shouting at the start of the episode fucking doomed us.
Yes. This is your fault. This is entirely your fault.
Are we ready to, I think we're ready to be done. We're going to do the author next week.
Yep. Housekeeping. Oh, wait. What are we reading this month?
We are reading The Electric Doppelganger, which is a book based on the works of Rudolf Steiner.
By based on, majority of it is just quotes from his lectures.
Yeah. Andreas Nieder is the editor who also penned the introduction and the afterword. He's the compiler that kind of strung together these quotes and ideas from Steiner and made them into a book that is comprehensible to people smarter than I am. It's 164 pages in the physical book, and only about 120 of those are actually like book, and that scares me, listeners.
Book.
It scares me.
It's a challenge. I'll say this. I'm a good chunk into it, or not a good chunk. I'm a little bit into it. And it is certainly a challenge compared to some of the stuff we've ever read, because what we're dealing with is not just translated works, but then translated, recontextualized, and stitched together lectures.
Yeah.
It's not even about his writings. It's from a very specific series of lectures he gave where he touched on this topic that sounds a lot to me like Scientology, but I'm sure we'll get into that.
From what I remember, the works of Rudolf Steiner were drawn upon by L. Ron Hubbard to create Scientology. But L. Ron Hubbard was also he was drawing from everything, because honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, I think he also was drawing from Blavatsky.
I mean, that makes sense given his circle running around Jack Parsons
and Crowley.
He ran
around with Crowley and Parsons, so that makes sense.
Yeah, and he was creating Scientology. Like, this was L. Ron Hubbard was not a man suffering either from divine inspiration nor from delusional thought. It was a marketing tactic.
Yeah,
His sci-fi novels weren't selling well, so it makes sense that he was, you know, drawing from the same sort of stuff that Crowley and Parsons were, because he probably saw how marketable it was, particularly in an America that was growing increasingly frustrated with the dominant culture and was aggressively seeking alternatives to Christianity. It was basically, I felt like it was time for us to do Steiner. I will probably be getting back into true crime adjacent shit with Unleashed after our summer series. But as some people on the Discord saw, the poll results were leaning pretty heavily in favor of Electric Doppelganger. And I was ready to challenge myself again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
I think that's it. So we're ready for housekeeping?
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping.
So, if you liked what you heard, please like and subscribe on whatever podcasting platform it is that you are listening to us on. And if it's Spotify or Apple, leave us a review. 5 stars preferred, but not required. And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that at noctivagantpodcast@gmail.com or on social media, on Twitter at noctivagantpod, or I am at Mix Rory Wicks.
I am at Bearish Terror.
I'm at Midwest Undead.
And then we have an Instagram, noctivagant_podcast.
We have a Reddit account, Noctivagant Podcast.
We have a Tumblr account, Noctivagant Podcast.
And we'll have all these links in the bio, in the description, of course. But I think that is it. Any last final thoughts?
Dick cheese.
Dick cheese. Okay. Well, then go ahead and lead us out of here, Dick cheese.
All right. Good night, ghosties. Good night, ghoulies. Good night, moth people. Stay safe on those midnight roads.
It is always okay to accept popcorn from aliens.
Always. I agree. But also follow the signposts. Don't get lost.
Really, don't get lost. There are blue giants out there who are trying to have a private funeral, and they're going to be really, really offended if you disrupt the proceedings.
I don't care if they're offended. They're rape giants.
Not
blue giants just scatting all over everything. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-doo.
When you really get down to it, is Muppet Dick Cheese just lint?
Oh, God. It is.
It's not easy being green.